Hour.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America was rocked by news today that one of its own citizens has been implicated in an Al-Qaeda plot to detonate a radioactive dirty bomb, potentially in the nation's capital. The name on his Brooklyn birth certificate says Jose Padilla, but his Hispanic roots and American upbringing were recast when Abdullah al-Muhajir converted to militant Islam following a stint in a Florida prison. His allegiance to America was allegedly shelved when he began learning how to build a dirty bomb. Al-Muhajir's story throws a cold and disturbing new light on the global terror threat. Al-Qaeda bosses have boasted of being able to launch a nuclear strike against America, and now it looks like they were planning to do it, and an American was recruited to push the button. Just fingerprinting foreigners isn't going to keep America safe, not when Al-Qaeda is grooming homegrown operatives among disaffected and alienated American citizens. How vulnerable are we to a dirty bomb? Is Chicago's Jose Padilla just a blip on the terror radar, or should America really worry about an enemy within? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is James Walsh. He's executive director of the Managing the Atom Project at Harvard University's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. Good evening and welcome, James Walsh.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. Good to have you with us. Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Jim Walsh, walk us in, first of all, to the dirty bomb and the dirty bomb threat. I guess the first question is, how do you build one? How difficult is it? How much training would have been involved?
The most important thing to know about a dirty bomb or a radiological weapon is that it's not a nuclear weapon.
Mm-hmm.
It's a conventional explosive that has strapped to it radiological material, and so that when it explodes, rather than giving off shrapnel, it disperses little bits of radioactive matter. It kills primarily through the conventional weapon, the conventional blast. That's what will kill most people, not radioactivity. But it's a terror weapon. It's intended not only to kill but to cause fear, and it's unfortunately the easiest of the three versions of the nuclear threat. That is to say, stealing a nuclear weapon, mm-hmm. making your own nuclear weapon, or using this lower grade thing we call a dirty bomb. That, unfortunately, is does not pose many technical challenges.
How far can or would the radioactive threat from a dirty bomb spread? There was talk, U.S. officials saying that they believe the plan was to check out Washington, D.C. as a target. If you put one off, in the middle of Washington, how many square feet or blocks or what size area would become poisoned and might lead to the deaths of people who are within that area?
Well, there are at least three important variables here that would determine what the scale of the impact would be. The first and most important is the size of the conventional weapon. If you have a suitcase bomb, you can't fit much TNT in a suitcase,
mm-hmm.
and so the blast effect will be limited. Therefore, the dispersal effect will be limited.
Are you saying the dispersal effect of radioactivity does not go beyond the blast effect of the bomb?
It will, but it will be largely in that area. Also, the size of the blast effect will determine the extent to which that material gets dissolved into smaller and smaller particles. And the finer the particles, the more likely it will be able to stay in the air and drift. It's also, for certain types of radiation, not some types we worry about give off gamma rays. Another thing we worry about is alpha particles, and those you have to breathe in. So how finely small size the particles are ends up being sort of an important piece of it. But to answer your question, it's the size of the conventional blast. Is it a truck bomb or a little bomb? How much nuclear material do you have? And the type of nuclear material, because there are all kinds of nuclear material used for all kinds of uses, commercial, medical, and governmental. And so it depends on those things. When we run scenarios, we tend to look at the use of a average-sized bomb in a downtown area, and in part, the effects of that bomb are constrained because there are tall buildings which act as a buffer. And so we're talking about several large city blocks, but we're not talking about an entire city and we're not talking about an entire region.
So we might be talking about a few square blocks and the impact on people within that area. Would they just get sick or might they indeed die?
Well, I think people will die first from the blast. There'll be more people who are killed by the blast than the radiation exposure. The radiation exposure might add the risk of additional cancer deaths after a 10 or 20 year period that would take its toll later on. but in the early going, it would be the blast effects and some risk to the first responders. But first responders in most major cities, and here I'm talking about firefighters and police officers, they have equipment that will be able to indicate to them that there's something radioactive going on.
But this goes to your point that the radioactive piece of this is more perhaps a weapon of terrifying people than of actual physical damage.
Well, it is, but, I don't mean to minimize it. We've never in the nuclear age had the use of a radiological or dirty weapon before. This is not a threshold we want to cross, and it's not a threshold we have to cross if we get our act together and do what's necessary to prevent terrorists and others from gaining access to nuclear materials.
Where might terrorists get those nuclear materials, Jim Walsh?
Well, there are a couple of different sources, and because there are so many different radiological materials, and some are more dangerous than others. Well, you have the kind that you use to make nuclear weapons. I think those are the kind we're most concerned about. So that's plutonium and highly enriched uranium. And those are found in private research facilities at universities, at old weapons labs. And unfortunately, there are metric tons of that material that are spread out across the former Soviet Union, Russia and the former Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, more than half of the facilities that have those materials, at least according to the Department of Energy, don't have the level of physical protection and security we'd like to see to have confidence that they could protect that material from theft. And then other weapon states have, India, Pakistan, Israel have nuclear materials, as of course the United States does and others. So they're widespread in government use. And then you have them used for irradiating food to kill pests and diseases.
Mm-hmm.
You have it for medical uses, for cancer treatments and for diagnosis. You have it in the oil industry. Radiological materials are used to find deposits and to search for breaks in pipelines. And even things like smoke detectors have small amounts of radioactivity that performs an industrial application.
And Jim, why do you think Al-Qaeda appears to be so interested, consistently interested in manufacturing and exploding a dirty bomb?
Well, I think the interest is there. The extent of that interest remains to be seen. The Attorney General really did not reveal that much today. He said, I think the quote was that he was arrested because he was exploring a plan to build and detonate a radiological device, which is a pretty conditioned statement.
Yes, it is.
So we'll have to see what the evidence really turns up. But I don't think we should wait till the dirty bomb goes off to be concerned about this. There are we spend roughly $1 billion a year on this problem. We spend hundreds of billions of dollars a year on other things, military and other aspects of the fight against terrorism. And we are just doing such a woefully inadequate job on this that at least this will provide us the opportunity to do something about it. You know, the debate this past month was, when were we warned? Did we get enough specific warning to take action? Clearly, in this case, we have warning. We have specific warnings, and there are steps that we can take, and the only question is, are we going to take them?
And through it, we see that it does not take, as you say, a nuclear scientist to put together and detonate such a weapon.
No, unfortunately not. It requires someone who's skilled in conventional explosives. And to tell the truth, most of Al-Qaeda's resources, its training, its procurement, and its other sorts of activities, at least according to the documents we've collected in those safe houses and the evidence from the 60 sites in Afghanistan, their main focus was conventional weaponry. They know that conventional explosive very, very well. And that is the driver in a radiological weapon, is a conventional. So you take their expertise and you take vulnerable nuclear materials, and that's the bad combination we worry about.
James Walsh, thanks for joining us tonight.
Absolutely, Tom.
James Walsh is executive director of the Managing the Atom Project at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Jack Beatty, a dangerous weapon, but perhaps above all a weapon of terror, a weapon designed to freak people out.
Yeah, and a weapon to which a combustible element has just been added, an alienated American. I mean, we are an alienation machine in this country, from the lone berserkers to the high school mass murderers to Tim McVeigh. It has all happened here. And, you know, you connect one of our outcast furiosos raised on gun murder and fame through infamy, you connect him with Al-Qaeda, you know, which specializes in filling bitter cells with a cause, and you really have a new frontier in terror.
Jack, I want to turn to Robert Drogan. He's a reporter with the L.A. Times. He covers intelligence issues and is based in Washington, D.C. Good evening. Welcome, Bob Drogan.
Good evening.
Bob, thanks for being with us. Tell us what we really know at this point. As James Walsh was saying, there were a lot of conditioned statements in what we heard from the government today. What do we know about this arrest, or I guess I should say detention?
Well, we know he was arrested on May 8th in Chicago. He was coming in, it appears to be not from Pakistan, as the government announced, but from in the Middle East. There were FBI agents on the plane tracking him. What had happened was on March 28th, the government captured Abu Zubaydah, who was the alleged operations chief for al-Qaeda. This is in Faisalabad in Pakistan.
Very high ranking.
Very high ranking. And he, during his interrogation, gave up the fact that he had recently met with an operative who was interested in dirty bombs, didn't give the guy's name up. U.S. intelligence operatives and foreign intelligence services managed to figure out who this was based on what information they were able to get from Zubaydah and from other prisoners and documents, tracked him down, and caught him when he came into this country. It's that, you know, that's the good news side of it. The bad news side of it is they had never heard of this guy until that time, until a week or 10 days before he was arrested. And he had met, according to Zubaydah, in just a few weeks before the Americans captured Zubaydah. So you have to kind of scratch your head and say, so wait a second, this guy who we've never heard of has Abu Zubaydah's address, you know, before the entire U.S. government does. So it's a little worrying.
It cuts both ways, doesn't it?
Exactly.
What do you think this tells us, Bob Durgan? There's so many implications of this news today, but what does it tell us, I guess, first of all, about U.S. intelligence capacity? You're saying it cuts both ways, but also our interrogation procedures. How do you think intelligence officers got this information out of Abu Zubaydah? What would compel him to talk about something like this?
You know, everybody's wondering that, and nobody knows. I've talked to a lot of people about it, whether or not, you know, they've made some kind of deal with him, you know, take the death penalty off the table. There's some speculation that they've created some kind of alternate reality for him, you know, where they're feeding him fake stories, you know, that bin Laden is singing like a canary. I mean, who knows? We don't even know where he is. He's reported to be on a U.S. ship. He's reported still be in Pakistan. You know, this is just guesswork. And it may well be, frankly, that he's not saying a word and we're just being told that he is. It's not implausible either that they're putting this out, or at least they're over-dramatizing what it is he's actually saying in an attempt to make al-Qaeda operatives elsewhere a little nervous and see what it, you know, flushes out into the bushes a bit, or into the bushes.
Well, that's interesting. What do you think it means to have this kind of intelligence victory right now after the recent exposures of poor information management?
Well, it remains to be seen what kind of victory this is. I mean, it's clearly a victory for the Bush administration in their effort to show that they're doing something in the war on terrorism. It remains to be seen what the evidence is, and we may never see it since he's now been moved to a military prison where he won't even get a lawyer. You know, this is not, let's be real clear, this is not a man who had a bomb. This is a man who had, at best we are told, information about a plan for possible use of a bomb with materials that, as far as we know, they didn't have. We already knew, we already had been told that al-Qaeda was interested in acquiring a radiological weapon. We have no further information today. In fact, I specifically asked, we have not been told that they have acquired a radiological bomb. So let's not jump to conclusions here. We don't know what this guy is yet.
So are you suggesting or just suspecting, Robert Durgan, that the news today is overblown somehow, that the weight of the announcement is being exaggerated?
Well, I'd be shocked to think that the United States government would overplay news events for its own, or for anyone else to do that for its own purposes. You know, it's obviously a major development. This is someone who the Attorney General has declared a known terrorist, despite the fact that he hasn't been tried or convicted of anything. He is someone who has come into the country. The information we're told, he had met with al-Qaeda. He's obviously an operative of some kind, and he was apparently doing some kind of reconnaissance effort. How far along the plan was, how developed it was, what his actual intentions were, you know, we really don't know.
And, of course, perhaps you're right to chuckle at the suggestion of it being exaggerated, but we're talking about radioactive weapons here, and that is really toying with Americans' emotions, if it's toying at all. We're talking tonight about the dirty bomb threat, the implications of the announced detention. detention of an American citizen who was reportedly doing reconnaissance for a dirty bomb in the United States. What are the implications of the dirty bomber's apprehension? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a dirty bomb threat, apparently represented by an American citizen working for, with Al-Qaeda, and about the implications of all that, the dirty bomb and the Americans' apparent, alleged participation. What do you think? If Americans join the terrorists, how do we stop the threat? And how do you think U.S. authorities got this information out of Al-Qaeda captive Abu Zubaydah? Do you care how they got it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Robert Drogan. He's a reporter with the L.A. Times based in Washington, D.C., covering intelligence agencies. Bob Drogan, when you look at the news today, does it throw Al-Qaeda in any different light? What are the implications of this news on how we think about their intentions, and is it different as a result?
Yeah, I think one of the most interesting things to consider here is what does this mean about the profiling that the government has done about terrorist suspects? We've all been told a great deal about the threats or potential threats from Arabs and North Africans and whatnot, but look who's now been actually captured. You have Zacharias Moussaoui, who holds a French passport. He's the alleged 20th hijacker. Mm-hmm. You have Richard Reed, the alleged shoe bomber who was going to blow up the flight to Miami. He has a British passport. And now you have this guy who is born in Brooklyn and apparently a Latin background and is an American citizen. So, you know, either for ethnic or geographic or racial or citizenship purposes, you know, who are they checking? Who should they be checking? And how does this mean? And the answer is in part that in fact Al-Qaeda has a history of of reaching out to Americans. There were American citizens involved both in the post World Trade Center plot of 1993 when they were going to blow up bridges and tunnels. There was an American involved in the 98 embassy bombing case. So they are clever enough to realize that perhaps America's greatest vulnerability is and their greatest asset would be to find an American, sympathetic American with a clean passport who can move in and out of this country without the problems that they would otherwise have.
And to Jack Beatty's earlier point, Bob Drogan, do you have the sense that U.S. security agencies are starting to factor in the danger of alienated Americans, of alienated friendlies, French, British, or even American origin?
Well, sure. I mean, they've got John Walker Lind in custody, who was the American Taliban or is accused of that, who was captured in Mazar-e-Sharif last year, and another guy who was caught, who was born in New Orleans, and Timothy McVeigh. I mean, there's a long history of, you know, terrorism in this country for a variety of purposes, causes, and ideologies. But this one is different, obviously, something involving even though this is not a weapon of mass destruction, it is a weapon of mass terror, and it's in service of ostensibly a foreign, if not a foreign power, certainly a hostile group, and that kind of raises everybody's tension levels.
Robert Drogan, thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Robert Drogan is a reporter with the L.A. Times covering intelligence agencies out of Washington, D.C. Listeners, what do you think of throwing an American citizen into military custody beyond the legal system if he may indeed be a terrorist threat? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beatty, you can hear the wheels turning here as once again we try to adapt to a world that is more complex and potentially threatening from more angles than we'd like to think.
Yes. I mean, American passports, British passports, French passports. What has this done to our profiling system, our sense of where the danger is? Each day opens a new dimension. And, you know, it really raises the question, just to underscore it, that James Walsh brought up, which is one of priorities. These, as I understand it, the one of the worst scenarios with the radiological bomb is the container, you know, coming from a truck-sized container coming from abroad. And less than 5% of these are currently inspected. And last week, Fred E. Clay, the former Reagan defense official, said that the Energy Department was stalling on coming up. He said they need to have a Manhattan Project to devise some sort of instrument that could tell whether a radiological bomb was in one of these places from a distance. And he said, what are they waiting for? Well, of course, what are they waiting for? Partly they're waiting for funds. They're waiting for manpower. And where is it going? Well, we have a defense budget that's heavily weighted now toward Cold War weapons. And we don't have a Cold War threat here. And I just think that the public has got to get in on this, that to be safe, we're going to need an adjustment of what we call defense.
It looks like it's coming down the pike. Listeners, what are the odds that we can stop every dirty bomb? Are we seeing the birth of an enemy within, American allies of al-Qaeda? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I want to welcome into our conversation Rohan Gunaratna. He's author of Inside Al-Qaeda, Global Network of Terror, and is a research associate at the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at St. Andrews University in Scotland. Good evening and welcome, Rohan Gunaratna.
Good evening.
Rohan Gunaratna, take us into al-Qaeda and its recruitment efforts a bit here. How does this organization reach out to an American like Jose Padilla and make him part of its own?
Al-Qaeda maintains both operational and support cells in North America and in Western Europe. Al-Qaeda tends to target both migrant and territorial communities in this particular region. And it is mostly done by ideological indoctrination. And once people are recruited, they are transported back to the liberated theaters of jihad, as they call it. And then they receive training.
And by that you mean Middle East or Central Asian areas, Pakistan, Afghanistan formerly?
Absolutely. But their main training base has always been Afghanistan, which has now been... Now that has suffered severe disruption. But there are alternative theaters of jihad that have already emerged.
Are you saying, Rohan Gunaratna, that al-Qaeda is particularly interested in or focused on recruiting converts to Islam, migrants from beyond the Middle East?
Absolutely. In fact, they have stressed on this particular aspect. And it is because... American citizen or a European citizen could travel unhindered and would be above suspicion.
Does it turn out that these American or European recruits are good for carrying out acts of terror? Are they particularly somehow not just hard to recognize, but open to that kind of order?
Yes, in fact, the experience in Europe very clearly demonstrates that other than the cradle Muslims, the new converts to Islam are more committed and more determined.
What's your sense of the psychology that's going on there, if that's the case?
We know very little about the psychology of the new converts to Islam in terms of commitment and determination to commit acts of violence. But what we have seen on the surface is that they are willing to kill and to die to conduct suicide terrorist operations.
Rohan Gunaratna, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation David Kaplan. He's an investigative reporter with U.S. News and World Report and author of the article Made in the USA, Hundreds of Americans Have Followed the Path to Jihad. Here's How and Why. Just came out, I guess, very recently in U.S. News and World Report, the current issue. Good evening and welcome, David Kaplan.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. You have said in your article that there are a lot of American al-Qaeda. How many and how do we know?
Well, your guest is absolutely right on the mark. Al-Qaeda has been very interested in Western recruits and Americans in particular, and there's a long history of this. What we did was set out several months ago to start tracking a fairly hidden history of American jihadists going overseas. This has been going on for 20 years. We found Americans who had fought converts, naturalized citizens, green card people, who fought in holy wars in Chechnya, in Bosnia, in Kashmir, as well as in Afghanistan against the Russians. There are hundreds and hundreds of these people. It's like the Abraham Lincoln Brigade in the 1930s, except this is jihad.
But David Kaplan, are these Americans who set out with malice toward America in their hearts, or are they initially drawn to Islam as a religion and somehow slowly pulled over to an anti-American view?
Well, in fact, the U.S. Backed some of these struggles. We certainly backed the jihadist movement in Afghanistan against the Russians. We were, we supported struggles in against the Russians in Chechnya and against ethnic cleansing in Bosnia. But what happened was in the 1990s, the jihadist movement fundamentally changed. It became increasingly radicalized, virulently anti-American, and they began plotting attacks against us. And the first one that we really sat up and took notice of was the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, mm-hmm. the first attack.
But how does an American get pulled onto this road to jihad, as you call it?
There's a number of ways we found. It's quite diverse. I mean, there's a reason why you've got people from 33 different countries at Guantanamo Bay being held by U.S. authorities now. There are evangelical groups that try and recruit people. There are fairly sophisticated web pages. There's unbelievable stuff out on the Internet, these jihadist pages that we've listed on our website, usnews.com. You can mm-hmm. go check those out. And then there are radical mosques and Islamic centers where you can, you know, informally find ways. They used to have open recruitment centers, more than 30 across the United States.
Do American jihadists come mainly from among Arab Americans or not? Where do they draw from?
Yeah, most of the ones we tracked more than three dozen American jihadists. Most of, but we believe there were, you know, more than 1,000, maybe as many as 2,000. Most we believe are Arab Americans. Most are born overseas. But a significant number are African-American, who represent about a third of the American Muslim population. But there are all kinds of people. John Walker Lind, a wealthy white kid from Marin County, and mm-hmm. And now this guy in the news today.
Jose Padilla, originally.
He's the second Latino we've heard of. There was a Puerto Rican fellow named Hiram Torres whose name turned up in a jihadist safe house in Afghanistan a few months ago.
We know that Islam, maybe the black Muslim movement, but maybe also an Islamic movement, is quite alive in America's prisons. Are prisons particularly a recruiting ground, or would that be wrong to say?
I can't really say. It's something we're interested in looking at. There are radical imams, you know, in different places in the United States. There are probably some in prisons, but I think it's been the salvation for a lot of people too. Just as Christianity has pulled some people out of a less than desirable life, but you know, you're talking about a radical fringe here. Even if it's as many as 2,000 people, you know, there's more than 4 million American Muslims.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, what do you think? We're talking about the dirty bomb threat, the implications of an American delivering that threat or being prepared to plan it. What are the implications of the dirty bomber's apprehension? And if Americans join the terrorists, how do we stop that threat? Robert is on the line. Welcome, Robert. You're on the air.
About this guy they got today.
Hello, Robert. Are you there?
Yes, I'm there.
You're on the air.
Thank you. Hello?
Yes, you're on.
Hello. I think we're missing a central point here, and that is that this guy was arrested on May 8th. And we're expected to believe what our government tells us, and our government never tells us the truth. And this is obviously a propaganda thing to say that they're doing something against the war on terrorism.
Well, we touched on that with Bob Drogon earlier. You think
You didn't. You touched on it, but you didn't address my point.
Yes, we did touch on it, and now we'll address your point. And your concern is that it's all one big smokescreen?
No, it's not a smokescreen. It's to make the government look good when the government needs to look good.
David Kaplan, how about that? Based on your research, does this look like the government's pulling something out of its back pocket when it's not looking so great on other fronts? It's been criticized by FBI agents in Congress. Is this just something being trotted out? Should the American public be concerned it's being grossly manipulated here?
Well, I wouldn't go as far as the caller, but he makes an interesting point. You know, there's a reason why this got released today. This guy's been held in captivity for over a month. There may be a more rational explanation in the sense that authorities needed time to chase down the leads while they had this guy, figure out who else is part of his network, and keep everything quiet. And the network's cover was probably blown by now, so there was no harm in releasing it. The fact that, you know, the Attorney General does a press conference from Moscow, and then we have three top officials today from the FBI and the Defense Department and the Justice Department all talking about this one case. I mean, you know, sure, they were milking it for its publicity factor.
Rohan Gunaratne, how does it look to you from across the Atlantic, observing from Scotland? Does it seem like a responsible handling of this case? Do you get the sense that there's something being exaggerated here, or are we underestimating possibly the threat of al-Qaeda units still in the U.S.?
We have known of al-Qaeda's interest to use CBRN, chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear devices for a long time. This is one group that has had a sustained long-term interest to develop, acquire, and use this type of weapons. So this fits into the pattern of al-Qaeda, the modus operandi of al-Qaeda. And of course, the fact that the U.S. government did not come out with this before boils down to the very fact that it's important, as the previous gentleman mentioned, that they needed more time to conduct further investigation to discover the complete network that was supporting this particular operation.
But Jack Beattie, we sense some skepticism voiced here by one of our listeners, probably not alone, about the shape of announcements now coming out about terror. Once the political dynamic gets in gear and the government needs to have some CYA, it may be hard to sort out the relative weight and importance of individual announcements.
Yeah, and I think the administration is responsible for a lot of that. I mean, last week, just when Agent Rowley was going to testify on Capitol Hill, they rushed out this government reorganization plan. Tom Ridge said on Sunday that Colin Powell had not been consulted about it. They hadn't had time to talk to Dom Rumsfeld. It had been prepared in secret in the White House by the White House staff, and sort of been prepared as a kind of their own quick a bomb to sort of ignite when other things were going on. So we may well need a Department of Home Security, and that may be a good idea. The way they released it was clearly and patently political. And so here again, we may, you know, we should probably be grateful that they got this. We are grateful that something worked. They got this guy, but, you know, but the way they release it makes it look political.
David Keflin, just 30 seconds. On the other hand, you've come out with a big story almost at the very same time saying, hey, there's a real threat here among not just people of Middle Eastern nationality, but among Americans.
Yeah, I guess I'm more sympathetic to some of these guys, particularly the ones in the streets who are trying to chase these bad guys. One friend who works in the area likened it to a hockey game. He said, you know, you can deflect 50 shots and you let one puck go through and you've lost the game. And the government screwed up. Yeah, we need to do better. There's a lot of guys who are out there and women who are working very hard on the front lines who go unnamed, and they're catching people like Padilla, allegedly.
David Keflin, Rohan Gunaratne, stand by. We're talking about the dirty bomb threat, the implications of an American character. What, or carrier, I should say, what are the odds that we can stop the next dirty bomb? And are we seeing the birth of an enemy within, American allies of al-Qaeda? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the dirty bomb threat and the implications of an American carrier. Maybe also the implications of interrogation, of investigation. What does it mean that this has come out now and that this news is front and center in our minds at the same time that there's so much investigation going on into the government's anti-terrorism efforts, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Rohan Gunaratna. He's author of Inside Al-Qaeda, Global Network of Terror, and a research associate at St. Andrews University in Scotland, and by David Kaplan with U.S. News & World Report, who reports in the June 10th issue that there are many American Al-Qaeda in an article entitled Made in the USA. You can join us as well. What are the odds that we can stop the next dirty bomb? And are we seeing the birth of an enemy within, of an American ally group, American allies of Al-Qaeda? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is, within the American Muslim community, are they actively involved in helping find these criminal elements, or are they more silent accomplices? Like when I lived in Utah, you know, all the good Mormons knew who the polygamists were, but no one ever turned them in. And I'm wondering what's going on here in the U.S. with the Muslim communities that we have.
Well, it's an interesting question. Thanks for the call, John. Of course, I guess not every, let's say, Christian knows every Christian fundamentalist, but let's put it to David Kaplan. David, you've looked at this. How wide would you say awareness is among American Muslims of this problem, and are they in a position to be helpful, to be more helpful?
I'm a little hesitant to answer the question. I think it's best addressed by some Muslim clerics and community leaders. I can tell you from talking to Islamic scholars, to various imams around the country, you know, it's a very traumatized community right now. There are people who are worried about arrests. There are a lot of people being held without being charged. They're worried about racist attacks and discrimination. So it was, you know, I've spent my career going after people like, you know, neo-Nazis and cultists and mobsters, and it was extremely hard to get people to talk about terrorists in or even sympathizers in these communities. You know, it's just shut down very tightly, and I would assume law enforcement's having the same trouble. You know, and I just want to stress that, you know, the vast majority are very law-abiding. You know, we're at most we're talking about hundreds of people in a community of millions.
Rohan Gunaratna, what about the pattern internationally? You've looked at this in the U.S. and in Europe and the U.K. What's the dynamic you see around Muslim centers? There are very mixed feelings about U.S. policy, I assume, in the Middle East. And yet, as David Kaplan says, a large, overwhelming majority of law-abiding citizens. Is this community a rich seedbed or not for this kind of slippery slope toward terrorism?
There has been a significant Al-Qaeda penetration of Muslim territorial and migrant communities. And of course, at the same time, the biggest, the greatest source of information of Al-Qaeda activities happens to be the general public, especially the Muslim communities, because the vast majority of the Muslims do not want anything to do with Al-Qaeda or other Islamist terrorist organizations. Although there is a lot of support among the Muslims for struggles like Kashmir and Palestine and Chechnya, I believe that the future of security of this world to a large extent will rely on the ability of U.S. Law enforcement, security and intelligence agencies, as well as agencies of other countries, to work with the Muslims.
Rohan Gunaratna, what's your sense of the interrogation that apparently went on to get this information? What do you think it would take to get this very high-ranking Al-Qaeda captive, Zubaydah, to talk about such a specific case, to single out a single man who was on his way to the United States?
Well, if the information came out from Abu Zubaydah, then I believe that the United States have been very successful in breaking him down. But right now, although people are saying that the information came out from Abu Zubaydah, there is a question mark, because he's a very tough target in terms of cracking him, because we have known of his ideological commitment to Al-Qaeda.
Not easy to crack. Jim is on the line. Welcome, Jim. You're on the air. Hello, Jim. Are you there? I think we've lost Jim. Let's turn to another call here. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Rob is on the line. Welcome, Rob. You're on
the
air.
Good evening. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I got to tell you, when the news has been breaking today, I've been far more afraid by the attack on this man's civil liberties than I have been on the threat to this country. As your guests have pointed out, this man did not have a bomb. He had a conversation for which an American citizen is being turned over to the military incommunicado without his attorney. At some point, our society, if we're going to maintain what we are, we can't do this to our own people. He may be a scumbag. Maybe he belongs in jail, but he belongs in front of a federal court, a federal jury of his peers.
Jack Beatty, this was rather briskly taken to the Defense Department, out of reach of any legal representation for this man who hasn't been charged with a crime.
Yes, and you have to wonder about that. I mean, is one of the advantages of military custody that pressures can be brought upon a prisoner that can't be in the civil system? Is that one of the rationales for this? It seems to be working in the case of the of Abu Zubaydah. And are they trying to do the same thing here? I mean, I don't know. I'm just asking aloud, and I don't use the word torture. But is coercion of some kind, brought to bear in these encounters in military contexts that can't happen in civilian ones? Because why else would they? You know, what are their motives? In other words, for putting this in the military system, if it isn't somehow to get information out of him that the legal system couldn't. And I'm not saying that they're going to resort to it. I'm just raising that question.
Well, David Kaplan, is there a substantive reason that this needs to go to military to military custody and a military-style interrogation? I mean, beyond the obvious one, that if indeed there was a dirty bomb attack planned on the nation's capital, that could have been quite devastating to the both physically and psychologically. Does that justify taking a suspect right out, an American suspect right out of the legal system?
It's kind of hard to figure out. I don't know. I've covered some of the biggest terrorism trials of the last decade, and we haven't had any trouble prosecuting everyone from the first World Trade Center bombing to the embassy bombings in East Africa. And Bin Laden himself has been indicted in federal criminal court in the United States. I suspect it's not so much to torture the guy, and if that comes out, that's going to be one hell of a scandal. On any of these guys, if the U.S. military is physically beating the crap out of them, I suspect it's more that they're trying to protect sources and methods. They've got active investigations. They're eavesdropping electronically on these guys, and I have my doubts that Zubaydah is the source of all or much of the intelligence on this guy. There's the government's very interested in trying to show that Zubaydah has turned, that he's flipped to our side. That makes him untouchable on Al-Qaeda's side.
But at the same time, David Kaplan, as our caller Rob points out, this is an American citizen who's been whisked off into a kind of limbo. That is an extreme step.
Yeah, I think the caller's got a really good point. And it's, we in the media have tried to figure out who these hundreds of people are who were being held in custody, and they haven't been named. There's no paper trail. They haven't been charged formally in court. I mean, it's a little unsettling for American democracy.
Rory's on the line. Welcome, Rory. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My point again is, in support of the earlier caller, aside from civil liberties, I mean, the whole pattern is very curious. I mean, why is it that it took 8 or 9 months for the government to acknowledge the dots that could have been that could have been connected? And not only that, why is it that every time we have a foreign conflict, it takes us 5, 10, 20, 30, even 40 years to find out how dirty we played? And then why is it that instead of looking at the deeper causes, we're putting Band-Aids all over the place, which is costing us trillions of dollars, and now we are on a global witch hunt, which is going to completely alienate us. I mean, why is it that Europeans aren't buying our official lines? Why is it that some of our closest allies are not buying it either? So isn't it time that we, I mean, to me, it seems like an insult to an average American's intelligence in an intellectual sort of way. Mm. Why is it that we are being taken for a ride? And then, I mean, are we really that naive and gullible? I mean, why is it that we don't trust our government when it comes to local issues, but globally we are so ignorant that we basically believe everything that we're being told? Isn't it time to start a greater understanding process and dialogue, and starting locally, taking the local Muslim community into the confidence, and starting a dialogue and letting them do the self-policing here as well as overseas, which will be a lot cheaper as well as more productive?
We got it, and I thank you for the call. You put your finger right on the kind of disorienting spin cycle we can get into with terror. There are real threats, and we've seen it. We've seen the dead bodies, and yet you don't want to surrender all liberties. Rohan Gunaratne, you're in a great position to look on from abroad. What's your report card? How would you assess, in brief, the U.S. response to 9/11 so far? Does it seem like a fair balance of tactical effort to smack down the next threat and a strategic response that might ameliorate the conflict at its root?
The U.S. response to 9/11 has been appropriate militarily, because it has disrupted, degraded, and destroyed the Al-Qaeda infrastructure in Afghanistan. But Al-Qaeda is a global organization, and most of its infrastructure outside Afghanistan is very much intact. And the ability of the United States to destroy the Al-Qaeda infrastructure outside Afghanistan very much depends on the ability and the willingness of the U.S. to work with the Asian Muslim countries and the Middle Eastern countries, as well as other countries in the world. And in that sense, the United States need to develop a more multilateral solution instead of taking unilateral action. It's a very difficult process for the United States, being the only superpower. And the U.S. must seek to develop a more multi-pronged, not only military, but a political, economic, diplomatic dimension, a multinational dimension.
Let's try and get one more call. Peter's on the line. Welcome, Peter. You're on the air.
Yes, I had two comments. One is that everybody seems to be expressing worries over civil liberties, and I think that Justice Jackson's famous remark that the Constitution is not a suicide pact ought to be kept in mind, and I think many people would certainly not blanch at any means to extract information from these people, and in fact would welcome it and hope that the government is using whatever methods it needs to learn about and prevent mass attacks.
But it is interesting, Peter, isn't it, that the level of confidence that requires we put in our government agencies when an American is whisked away to a military facility incommunicado, we just have to take it at their word that he is the threat that he is represented as being.
Well, I'm not sure we have to take them at their word, but what I'm saying is that I think in general, most of the people I've spoken to have no hesitation in saying, by all means, use torture if necessary. A second point, though, is the French have been very successful at using members of the Muslim community against other members. For example, they make extensive use of disaffected Berbers from Algeria who have their own quarrels with the Arabs.
Mm. Peter, our time is running down, but we take that point, and we, who knows, we may see it, and we may see it sooner rather than later in the United States if this kind of internal threat continues. Thank you for your call, Peter. Rohan Gunaratne, I want to thank you for joining us tonight at a very late hour in Scotland.
Thank you.
Rohan Gunaratne is author of Inside Al-Qaeda, Global Network of Terror. And David Kaplan, thank you for being with us tonight.
Sure.
David Kaplan is an investigative reporter with U.S. News and World Report. He's author of the June 10th article, Made in the USA, Hundreds of Americans Have Followed the Path to Jihad. On Point is produced by Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're